Story number one. I've served as a ranger in the Bitterroot Wilds of Montana for almost 20 years. Most people assume the woods are serene, picturesque, calming if you let yourself listen long enough. But when you spend more time among the trees than many people spend with their own families, you begin to sense things others miss. Sometimes the forest seems alive, not in a poetic way, but in the way a living thing watches you, measures you, tests your place in its order. As a Salish man, raised among stories of caution and respect for the land, I've always tried to keep my feet steady and my eyes clear. I'd never say I scare easily, but the night I wandered into that hidden clearing, something shifted inside me that hasn't settled since. It had started as a routine patrol, a late summer night with mist pooling in the hollows, faint animal sounds trickling through the firs, and the hum of distant crickets. I remember clicking off the truck headlights, shouldering my pack, and stepping into the darkness with my torch cutting a pale tunnel through the brush. Rangers check up on lost campers, inspect animal tracks, keep the quiet order of the woods. Most of the time, if you find anything, it's a clumsy teenager's beer cans or the occasional shadow of a bear. That night, the trees on either side of the ridge pressed in close. Clawing branches detoured my path until, after about an hour, I veered through a thin copse and found myself in a clearing I didn't remember on the maps. Pines circled the spot, roots tangled and gnarled, as if the ground itself resisted being bare. My flashlight played across the trunks. Everything seemed all right at first. The kind of place you'd expect to find deer bedding down, peaceful and smooth. Then, sudden as a slap, the temperature dropped. It wasn't gradual, like the cool hush of midnight. It hit with a trembling force, a gust that cut through my uniform and pasted my sweat to my skin with cold needles. The air pinched, filling my lungs with ozone and something bitter, like old earth or grave flowers. Then came the signs. It's a family word. Signs. The subtle things the forest shows you when something isn't right. I felt it first in my stomach, nerves pulling tight. My ears buzzed, as if the air itself became thick. The hair on my arms bristled and a pressure built in my temples, pulsing with every heartbeat. I steadied myself, told myself it was likely altitude or a drop in barometric pressure before a storm, but my reasoning was thin even to myself. As I scanned the ground for animal tracks, a wave of dizziness bent me sideways. My vision sprouted tunnel-shaped shadows at its edges. My legs grew heavy and my neck prickled, as though watched by dozens of patient unseen eyes. The torch shook in my hand, its circle of light dipping and fluttering like a dying moth. A hot metallic pain sliced across my forehead. With a final nauseous lurch, the world snapped shut around me, and I dropped flat on my back into the wild grass. The morning sun cut through my eyelids, sticky and too bright. Its warmth brought me back with reluctance. When I opened my eyes, the world swam, but slowly resolved into a scene so bizarre and sharp that to this day, just the memory of it feels like ice down my spine. The clearing was transformed. Where before there had only been trees and brambles, thousands of dolls now swung from every branch and twig, some large as toddlers, some no bigger than a sparrow. Not the sort of friendly dolls you found in gift shops, but abominations, limbs wrenched into impossible angles, eyes scratched or altogether missing. Their faces pitted and warped, leered or grimaced, and several mouths were sewn taut. Others split open into howls. Some wore shreds of faded fabric. Others were naked, leaking sand or stuffing from ripped seams. Jagged red stains blotted their hands and faces, their torsos spotted as if with rust or blood. The doll swayed, catching the first rays of sunlight, moving as if nudged by invisible hands rather than mere wind. Each tree, each low-hanging bough, bristled with them, crowded so thick in places that hardly any bark showed through. For a moment, I thought I saw their eyes glinting, tracking the bare patch of ground where I struggled to get to my feet. From the corners of my eyes, shadows seemed to flicker behind the doll's twisted forms. In the silence, broken only by my own heart hammering, I caught the faintest echo, a sound almost like children whispering just below the edge of hearing. Instinct overrode reason. I staggered out from under the hanging dolls, slipping on grass, branches catching my arms, faces brushing my jacket with cold kisses. The wind, still biting and unnatural, chased at my heels as I ran, refusing to look back, lungs burning with exertion and panic. When I finally hit the road, I collapsed by the ranger station, soaked in sweat, rambling out the story to my shift partner. He laughed at me, said I was probably still feeling the effects of whatever knocked me out. Dehydration, low blood sugar, a fluke in the pressure systems. Rational explanations spilled from his mouth as easy as breath. But I insisted he come see. He shrugged, more amused than worried. We hiked back, my mind racing, half expecting to find the grisly scene just as I'd left it, or at least some evidence of a prank. Bits of string, scraps of cloth, rusty old toys. But when we reached the spot, the world had shifted again. The clearing was nothing. A patch of barren gravel, small stones sheening with dew under the rising sun. No trees with twitching branches. No dolls, stitched or stained. Not even the indentation in the grass where I'd lain the night before. My partner looked around, confusion mixing with concern, and finally suggested maybe I'd wandered further than I thought, or fallen somewhere else. Maybe I dreamt everything under the influence of a concussion. Visions conjured by fear, cultural stories, or subconscious memory. But I've combed every map, hiked every inch since. There's no record of any clearing at that coordinate. No tales of creepy dolls either, though the spirits are known to play tricks in these lands. The memory gnaws at me most at night, when the wind whistles through the pines and the shadows thicken between the trees. Every now and then, strung between branches or caught in the crook of a trunk, I'll glimpse something, a ragged scrap of cloth, a tuft of synthetic hair, and wonder if it could have been part of a doll, or nothing but forest refuse. Some might say the mind conjures things the body wants to forget, that time and isolation do strange things in the wild. Maybe that's true, but whenever the air grows still and cold, I can't help but remember the whispering silence, the pressure in my head, and those hundreds of glassy eyes staring from the trees. If it was all just a dream, why do I still wake some mornings with the feeling that I'm being watched? Story number two. I am Nathan and have worked for Alaska Park Services 2 summers back, an unremarkable assignment. Patching signs, picking up old fireworks and dog mess, chasing off people building unauthorized fire pits. It was a habit of walking miles of spruce-fringed trails, hearing nothing but the rush of leaves and the brittle click of my boots against gravel. Anchorage is not the wildest land in Alaska, but the woods out there bend more than light. Sound seems to curl in funny ways. Distances morph. I thought I knew what to expect. It was a Tuesday when the call came about illegal dumping on the Apple Creek Loop. I grabbed the truck keys and went with Brian, a laconic guy who'd worked maintenance for a decade. We followed the path with empty trash bags swinging from our belts, ready for a mound of beer cans or a broken TV set. The day was overcast, the kind where light feels watery, soaking everything in gray. Mosquitoes buzzed in the silent air that the trees drank up with patient thirst. There were almost no hikers, just a distant glimpse of a neon vest in the underbrush, fading till it could have been imagined. We were passing the flatter stretch near the marsh when Brian stopped. He squinted past a tangle of alders. In that moment, the air prickled, not because I saw anything, but because I saw Brian shudder. 20 yards back, there was a man crouched low behind a bush. I remember being struck by the whiteness of his skin, pale hair falling over his forehead, arms curving oddly at his sides, as though he were anchoring himself to the mossy ground, still as a branch under snow. Something about his posture was so ordinary and so utterly wrong. Not someone peeing, not someone stretching, not even a person hiding. He was just squatting there, staring at us with no attempt at pretense. The shapes his fingers made, almost curled, almost spread, reminded me more of a dog bracing for a sound than a person caught in an awkward moment. He saw us looking, and as if on cue, rose up too suddenly and flung his arms skyward in a pose of imitation joy. Body language, nothing to hide. But the stretch was forced, like moving a mannequin's arms. He strode out toward us, all in one motion, and his face split into a too wide smile. Brian relaxed and greeted him with the casual recognition of small-town neighbors. This part felt safe. The stranger was Jacob Lez, a builder who'd once put up a deck for Brian. Jacob claimed he'd gone off trail to pee, though he'd been crouched facing us, fully clothed, with no sign of relief or urgency. His gaze flickered back to the woods as if a fox might dart out, or something worse. Brian jabbered about needing to check for illegal trash. Jacob grinned wider and assured us he'd seen no dumping, eyes bouncing off mine, the smile never really changing. Eyes not really smiling at all. I watched his shoes, muddy but not like somebody had been off trail long. The tension in his jaw never went away. He started walking with us as we turned toward the lot, step perfect with our own, and it felt like being shadowed by an echo. something that shouldn't be right behind you. The conversation ended up mostly between Brian and Jacob. Houses, lumber prices, favorite local bars, the balm of familiarity. But my skin never settled. With every word, I kept glancing back at the bush where he'd crouched, imagining a black garbage bag or a smudge of disturbed earth poking from below, just out of sight. Nothing but leaves and broken sticks. My own mind wandering to the unlikely. What if he was dumping evidence and got interrupted? Yet no smell, no sign, not even a chip bag. The place was spotless, but the aftertaste of something sour lingered. Jacob finally split off, heading deeper down another trail. Brian shrugged and said he was weird, but always a little off. Probably had a camping spot nearby. I tried to focus on our task, to find what had been dumped, but we found no trash. Weeks passed, the weirdness faded, replaced by other mundane frustrations. Cash registers out of ink, lockers jammed with shoes that wouldn't be claimed till fall. Then 2 years later, Brian called me on a Sunday morning. News: Jacob Lez had been arrested on the suspicion of murder after a disturbance at a coffee shop. Shocking enough, but rumors in the station trickled in about other women, other states, other crimes. We heard about kits unearthed in Idaho, in Michigan, filled with cash, guns, plastic ties, IDs. Stashes built years apart and dug up as needed. The TV said Jacob had traveled the country with a black duffel bag, using trails as hunting ranges, sometimes picking targets at random. He killed a girl in Anchorage, buried her deep past the tree line. He'd been seen, apparently, on several trails, always alone, always with that same expression, still searching, but never overtly threatening. A heavy knowledge rooted itself in my chest. That crouch pose, waiting, watching us rather than hiding, took on a new flavor I couldn't peel away. My mind replayed that rising motion, the stiff arms, those glassy bright eyes. Did he mean to surprise us? Was he waiting for someone else? He could have just been resting, or looking for mushrooms, or perhaps he'd heard animal movement and was curious. There were rational explanations, but none settled the memory's chill. When Jacob killed himself in his cell before his trial, his secrets went with him. The police scraped the woods for clues, and I, driven by a compulsion I didn't admit even to myself, returned to Apple Creek. I moved through the bushes with a borrowed metal detector, hands shaking over the roots and rocks. Each beep from the detector set my heart wild, but there was only foil, an old can, a rusted key. No murder kit. Maybe I had imagined too much. Was he truly waiting for prey, or just a strange, lonely man enjoying a private moment in the trees? There was no answer to this question. Sometimes I see that crouched body in dreams, body indistinct but the eyes bright, watching. The explanation is likely mundane. Maybe he truly had to relieve himself. Maybe he was checking for moose or lost his wedding ring and came back to search. Alaska is full of loners, after all, drawn to the silence. Still, anytime I walk a trail and the woods lean in too quietly, I feel those eyes waiting just out of sight and wonder if some secrets are meant to nest there. Never quite seen, never quite explained. Story number three. I remember clearly the morning my brother Luke called me, his voice tight and grainy, like he hadn't slept at all. For most of his life, Luke had been level-headed about his work as a national park ranger. Just the right blend of caution and pragmatism. The months he spent out in Utah, in those wind-carved labyrinths and red sentinels of arches, left him less certain about things, though he'd never quite say why. He'd mutter about the landscape being hungry and unsettled, but always in a half-joking tone, as if serious acknowledgement would somehow cross a line. That season, his friend and fellow ranger, Sasha, told him a story. She'd been taking a much-needed solo kayaking trip, winding between slabs of sunburned rock, and camped near a swollen, sleepy bend of the Green River. The heat never fully left the air, even at midnight. She pitched her tent on a thin strip of sandy grass just above the water, her kayak tied with three knots to a driftwood branch. At some point in the night, a sticky, musky warmth woke her, cocktail of river mist and animal sweat. She remembered it later as a dream, only because she couldn't think of another word for it. Half asleep, Sasha thought she felt something moving outside her tent, a scrape and slosh like a heavy animal stepping in the river. Her breath sizzled in her ears. The sound wasn't thunderous, more deliberate, like someone trying not to be heard. When she finally unzipped the tent, the moonlight fell on the river's edge and illuminated a naked woman, skin reflecting like oily glass. The hair was wrong, matted, heavy, as if dripping with water or worse. The figure's stare, Sasha said, went through her, not at her. Then the figure lunged, dipping into and out of the water. Sasha described a pressure, hands cold as bone soap locking around her throat, forcing her backwards so her bare heels kicked involuntarily against the sand. She remembered clawing, twisting, desperate to get air. There was no voice, only the stink of algae and copper. She woke up inside the tent, upright, gasping until she vomited dry river dust. She claimed that was all, until morning. Only when the light slid in and she crawled out did she see tracks all over the bank. Not the prints of bare feet, but those of a big cat circled again and again around where she'd slept. Cougar tracks, the pads as wide as her hand. The kayak was untouched, but the sand was slashed virgin clean, like something had erased the night except for the impressions of its passage. No other signs remained. My brother told me Sasha was lucky to be alive. No sign of the cougar, and she wasn't bitten or mauled. But her throat felt bruised for days. She couldn't sleep in complete darkness for weeks after that, choosing to drag her tent close to other rangers or even sleep in her car when she could. Luke said this sort of incident was quietly common, though no one liked talking about those nights. He'd say he didn't usually care for ghost stories, but there were too many oddities he couldn't chalk up to nerves or wilderness paranoia. Rangers talked about phantom lights drifting across plateaus, distant music rising above the wind, and the feeling of being watched by something that didn't want to be seen. Sometimes hikers went missing for a night and returned pale, unable or unwilling to explain what happened. Digging deeper, I tried reading up on incidents in the Southwest. Drownings blamed on strange currents in placid streams, children sleepwalking out of their tents, following phantom voices. The rare unclaimed shoe found half-buried miles from the nearest trail, filled with river mud and bits of what looked like human hair. Luke mentioned that in some stretches of narrow canyons, sound carried oddly. Sometimes you could hear your own voice as if it was someone else's, answering you from just around a bend. One ranger confided, over whiskey in a campfire, about waking up to see his tent walls flex and bulge, as if pushed from the outside in slow, measured pulses. Each shove was accompanied by a watery slap and a faint fishy odor. Another time, he described a group hike where the entire party heard, on a windless afternoon, the laughter of children echoing from the rocks, only for a sudden cold wind to surge and scatter their voices in all directions. There were no children to be found. I visited Luke out there during the tail end of the season, with the maples flickering red against the cliffs. Even midday, the landscape felt heavy, the silence resting on my ears like wool. Once, as we hiked near an old marsh, I caught a smear of movement in the water below. A flash of skin, or maybe a muskrat darting under the reeds. The surface, for just a moment, rippled in a perfect human silhouette before smoothing out to glass. Even trying to shake off the feeling, I noticed goosebumps surging up my arms despite the heat. We checked remote campsites after one bad windstorm. Whole patches of ground flattened as if enormous bodies had rolled there. My brother noted with a frown that some prints in the mud looked wrong. Elongated, with a hint of toe marks but no defined heel. A crew chalked it up to deer or elk stumbling on the softened soil, but a few of the rangers kept glancing sideways into the brush. One night I woke in my own tent to the sound of my name being whispered. At least it sounded like my name, stretched thin and submerged, coming from the riverbank. I told myself it was just wind in the salt bush, or maybe Luke checking on me. But his tent zipper never moved, and the sound faded only when I pressed my hands tight over my ears, pulse hammering so fiercely I could taste blood at the back of my throat. Nearly a year later, after returning to my small city apartment, I still find myself sometimes waking up gasping for breath for no reason. Anytime I hear running water, even from a faucet, I remember the sick weight in my chest and the slim, wet strangle of Sasha's retelling. I tell myself it could all be nerves, lucid nightmares, the brain's knots after dusk, the power of suggestion from too many half-seen stories. And who knows? Maybe that region is just more primal than most, the night wildlife just smarter, and the mind more eager to fill gaps in the dark. But sometimes when I listen to my brother talk, still careful with his words, I catch the way his eyes dart to the window as the sun sets. And I wonder whether the wilderness has more patience than people suspect. Whether out there some things follow you long after you've gone, silent and persistent, like the marks of claws in drying river mud. Story number 4. This happened a few years back. I've always considered myself practical. Someone who runs into a problem, solves it, and moves on. Rational by nature. I've worked as a park ranger for over a decade, managing shifts at one of those historic seaside parks where old stones are more common than visitors. There's an old lighthouse there, crumbling into the sea with every hard winter. Next to it is the visitor's center, which used to be the lighthouse keeper's home back when ships still steered by stars. Last summer, they stuck me with the graveyard shift. They said the night was always quiet, nothing to worry about. Usually that meant sharpening pencils, slapping at mosquitoes, and checking perimeter sensors. Still, there's something about army forts and ruined lighthouses that makes the dark feel heavier, like the night leans in and doesn't want to leave. That night, the air was thick, scented with salt and old brick. At around 2 a.m., I left the stuffy watch desk and strolled out into the courtyard. There were bullet-pocked blockhouses crumbling into moss, the lighthouse long abandoned, just a hollow pillar of mute stone. But among the shadows, something caught my eye. A light, soft and golden, shining from the second-floor window of the visitor's center. My stomach did a slow curl. The quarters were closed for repairs, sealed so tight that rats gave up. Maintenance had left strict instructions, no one in or out. I tried to tell myself it was nothing. Maybe a ranger, someone on the day shift, left it on. But as I walked up the path, the crunch of gravel under my boots sounded too loud. I paused in front of the old door. The lock dangled from the latch, thick with dust and looping spider webs that hung, glimmering faintly from dew. The webbing connected undisturbed from the lock to the railing, a shrouded net. It hadn't been touched in weeks. That should have sent me running, but instead my mind spun out excuses. Bad wiring, storm surge, a trick of the eye. Besides, I had the master keys. When I slid the key into the cool, corroded lock, the metal groaned like it hadn't been opened in years. I stepped inside. The quarters had that dead, musty coldness that old buildings get when no one lives in them. My breath fanned out, briefly visible, and the air felt damp, thick enough to taste. It smelled of seaweed, dust, and something sharp, like scorched metal. Every footstep echoed, the floors creaking under ancient boards, my own presence breaking a silence too deep for comfort. I called out, though there was no real chance of an answer. My words flattened against empty stone and returned to me twice, like distant footsteps closing in from behind. I swept the rooms, each one frozen in gray dust, motes fluttering in the shaft of my flashlight. Abandoned chairs, a chipped teacup with a dried ring inside. Nothing touched for years. No fresh footprints, no notes, no spin of a recent presence. On the second floor, I followed the light to the one unlocked door. My hands shook at the knob. The room was empty. The bulb flickered, humming overhead, showering harsh light over the faded linoleum. There was a chair pressed too close to the window, a perfect view of the lighthouse's ruined face. But the seat glistened with a slick of dust that should have been disturbed if anyone had sat there. I turned off the lamp, and as its glow died, the room seemed to sigh, a cold draft slithering up my arms. On autopilot, I locked everything behind me and stepped back into the night. My eyes never left the upper window. The building loomed, silent and inert. But then, just as I turned to leave, something shifted, a shape pacing slowly along the inside of the window, backlit against the darkness. It moved just out of direct sight, unnatural, like watching film played at the wrong speed. I tried to laugh it off. My mind insisted on a trick of light, maybe my own reflection. I climbed into the car, engine trembling beneath my hand. But through the dusty windshield, the light upstairs snapped back on, flooding the window again. This time the pane was occupied. Someone was there, staring out, face half shaded. The figure's posture was wrong, too stiff, with a sheen to his glasses that didn't reflect any real light, standing mannequin still in a cloud of burnt gold glare. I should have left, but something acidic curled in my gut. Some strange compulsion. The hope for an ordinary answer. The dread of confirming it wasn't. I grabbed my flashlight and returned. The lock was engaged, unmoved. The cold as I entered was bitter now, biting like the moment you open a freezer on an August afternoon. Each stair groaned, and I could hear the blood thundering in my ears, the sound blending with the old building's gentle, constant settling. On the second floor, there was no one, just the same empty corridors, the smell of mothballs and mildew more pungent than before. The chair hadn't moved. I called again, quieter, straining to catch even the scrape of a breath. Nothing. I felt the urge to turn, unable to shake the pressure of someone watching, someone just out of sight. That's when I heard the scratching, faint at first, then sharper, a roughness like fingernails down old wood, inches behind me. I spun, floodlights sweeping across bare walls. The sound stopped. There was nothing there, just shadows nested deep in the room's corners, dust haloed in motes like disturbed cobwebs. I don't remember leaving, really. I know I killed the light, stumbling down the stairs, head buzzing with static. I relocked the door with shaking hands. Glancing up as I hurried to my car, there it was, the same faint glow, and again the figure, pressed up against the window, eyes blacked by shadow, mouth too still to be real, or just the glass distorting his features. I drove away, the steering wheel slick with sweat. My brain churned out explanations. Electrical faults, reflected headlights, sleep deprivation twisting shadows into faces. The rational world insisted it was nothing, that the building was as dead as the lighthouse stones. But every so often I still dream of that room, of an unblinking man in dusty glasses, waiting just inside the light. Some nights, while passing the quarters, I catch a glimmer in the second-story window. I never stop to check anymore. Maybe there's a logical answer to all this, something easy and safe, or maybe the lighthouse wasn't as empty as I believed. Either way, the memory never fades. The building just keeps watching, quietly, through the dark. Story number 5. I have been a park ranger for nearly 7 years now. My name is Tyler, and I am in my late 30s. It's an old trade in my family. My father wore the uniform for decades before me, and I grew up wandering those same pine-shadowed trails, learning how the forest watches back. There's a solitary grace to working in the woods, but there is also a heaviness you don't notice at first, a collection of stories pressing at your back with every step. Even now, sometimes I dream about the things I've seen in these endless acres, but none unsettled me like the case of the missing girl. It happened at the start of September 3 years back, when the sun had just begun washing gold into the maples and the air snapped cool at dawn. I remember because it was before dawn on a frost-tipped morning when my radio crackled, poorly relaying desperate voices, not hunting injuries or lost dogs, but a missing child. I dressed fast, each movement somehow rushed and deliberate at once, and met the search officers at the lot where the forest road turns to gravel. The girl, her mother said, had disappeared from right in front of her. Her and her own father, the girl's grandpa, huddled at the edge of the trail, waiting desperately at the base of a great leaning birch. The mother's face was all shock and shivering lips. She could barely speak. Her daughter had scampered up the lowest branches to get a better view, they said. They watched her red jacket flicker through the leaves, a candy-colored flash in the green. Then, it just stopped. No branches snapped underfoot, no cheery exclamation, no movement above. They called her name until their throats cracked, and the woods answered only with the hush of wind and rustle. When I saw the tree, I felt a strange pressure inside, like an arch pressing against itself. The birch wasn't particularly tall, its bark smooth and papery, easy enough for a child used to climbing. Around the roots, the ground was trampled and soft, the shape of small sneaker treads pressed into the mud. Nothing above seemed broken, no sign that a body had fallen and vanished beneath fern or root. The mother insisted they had both watched her go up, but there were no retreating marks, no trail where she'd jumped down and run off. Her grandpa, in his pale raincoat, stared blankly up into the canopy as if time itself might tumble their granddaughter back down to them. I decided finally to climb the tree myself. Maybe she'd gotten stuck or fainted into the crook of a branch. With cold knees and a churn in my gut, I heaved myself into the crown, every inch of bark chilling beneath my palms. The higher I climbed, the more I saw. The thick patchwork of crown branches, bird droppings, the bright shreds of a jay's nest, but nothing else. No jacket, no shoes, no child. And strangely, no places where the bark was disturbed above the third thick limb. I called down, my voice catching on the hush. The family members below shrank in the blue morning, so still it made me shiver. We brought out dogs later. A search line combed every inch in a circle expanding from that birch. Her scent stopped at the roots. That's all. Just an end. As though she'd been vacuumed straight upward, or simply erased. The forest, so good at remembering everything else, held no trace of her. No candy wrappers, no dropped hat, no sound. And as we searched again and again, I kept noticing the birds kept silent whenever we drew near to the birch, only resuming their calls once we got far away. The mother was convinced. Her daughter had gone up that tree. She'd watched, waiting, until the branches stopped moving. They had called, searching the sky, but heard nothing except the soft, rhythmic pattering as the morning breeze stirred the canopy. The first night we gathered at camp set up through the woods, the light from our lanterns seemed to barely pierce the darkness. Sometimes, deep in the hours when I should have been sleeping, I thought I heard branches shifting, a soft, uneven creak, as if something far larger than a girl was climbing through the trees above. More than once I got up and checked, shining my flashlight skyward until the shaking stopped. I could feel eyes in the woods, patient and silent. On the third morning, when our search dogs again refused to pass by the birch, backs bristling, one of the volunteers said the missing girl must have run away before anyone noticed. But the mother swore it was impossible. Her backpack, water bottle, and phone were all still at the base, untouched. Only the shadow of her sneakers, pressed in the muddy roots, gave any sign she'd ever stood there at all. Some of the older rangers said the place had its legends, that there were thin places in the forest, cracks in the world where sometimes things went missing, that trees sometimes swallowed up the people who loved them most. But I've seen enough animals curled safe in hollow trunks to know how, usually, nature isn't in the business of magic. Usually, we searched for a week, spreading wider each day. The press and helicopters came and went, and the girl's mother and grandfather lived in a taut, silent agony. No body was ever found, no shoe, not even a scrap of the red jacket. Even the police admitted defeat, as if she'd vanished into the air. The only thing I found odd, I kept returning to the tree on my own, unable to help myself. The first week I found scratches high up the trunk, higher than any normal reach. They looked new, as if someone, or something, had tried clawing its way up or down, the bark scored in uneven patches. A week later, the bark beneath my hand felt icy, even in the late afternoon sun. And once, as I stepped down, I could have sworn I heard a giggle far above, a fluting, hollow sound, like the echo of a sound made days before. The logical part of me, the part that has to write reports and account for every missing hiker, knows there must be an explanation. Perhaps she fell and crawled off, disoriented. Perhaps she was snatched away in the single moment her grandfather looked away. Yet the searchers found nothing. No scent, track, or struggle. Birds avoided the tree for weeks. The dogs, even now, still balk if led near. Sometimes after a storm, I go back and stand at the foot of the birch. The rest of the woods seem utterly normal, perfectly ordinary. But beneath that tree, when the wind picks up, I can feel the hair on the back of my arms rise. If I listen, I almost think I can hear footsteps above me, very faint, pacing and pacing across the limbs, like someone searching for a way down, still lost, still just out of reach. I have to believe in science. I have to believe in facts. But I also know there are places in this world where answers are thinner than they ought to be. And every so often, I remember that missing girl and the way the forest sometimes holds its breath, the way the trees themselves sometimes seem to hide a secret, only for those who care to notice. Story number 6. I started trail running 2 years ago when work got too heavy and my doctor started making noises about cholesterol and blood pressure. Since earlier I had already been a park ranger, it was easy for me to go through the forests, enjoying the solace and cool breeze you felt while running through the woods. I took to the forest trails because they were quiet, empty before dawn except for the occasional deer or squirrel, and the air felt thick and ancient between the pines. I always ran with my old fleece and neon vest, nothing flashy, just enough to keep from getting shot by some half-awake hunter in the autumn gloom. On my first few months of morning runs, summer into early fall, I didn't see anyone, not a soul. The stone markers at the trailhead were always covered in old leaves, dew fogging over the padlocked donation box. I grew used to the silence, the monotonous slap of shoes over pine needles, the ragged steam of each breath. The world felt bigger, lonelier, in the pre-dawn hours. It must have been late September when I saw the orange hoodie for the first time. Just caught the flicker of color at a bend ahead, bobbing lightly up and down. Figured it was another runner, someone young, tall, moving fast. I thought it might be nice, some company after all the solitude. But before I got close, the figure turned off at a fork I usually avoided. An abandoned side path choked with windfall and old trash. The next few mornings I started seeing him again, always just at the edge of vision through the trees, cutting through the mist, shoes thumping softly. He never seemed to stop, not even at the sharp curves or muddy banks. I'd push myself, pick up speed to catch him, wanting, if I'm honest, proof that my mind wasn't playing tricks or that I wasn't running in circles. Every time, though, he slipped away before I could get a real look. Just the back of the orange hoodie in the wavery half-light, just out of range. Early October, the forest started thinning, frost on the ground. That's when things got weirder. One morning, I came around a bend and caught the runner stopped up ahead, shoulders rising and falling. He stood perfectly still, body tense as a statue, and I felt that primitive prickle on my neck that says not to get any closer. The air felt wrong, thick, muffled. Even the birds had gone quiet. As I slowed, he turned his head and looked right at me. I thought maybe I'd see a flash of features, tired teenage face, maybe a headlamp. Instead, his face looked blank, almost plastic. No details, no eyes, no mouth, just a soft curve like a mask under the hood. For a second, my throat closed up. Then he bolted so fast I couldn't believe it, gone into the darkest stand of pines, almost making no sound. I stopped, chest hammering, and tried to tell myself it was just fog, maybe a balaclava. Poor eyesight. Still, I turned and jogged home early, feeling like I was being watched the whole time. That weekend, I told my brother what I'd seen, framing it as a joke. Probably some ultra-marathoner in reflective gear, maybe one of the locals who liked to run with a face mask in cold weather. He shrugged and said nothing ever happened on that trail, a quiet, safe place. Even so, I stopped listening to music on my runs, ears straining for footsteps that might be following me, heart leaping every time a branch snapped or a squirrel darted. It got colder. Leaves skittered, darkness pressed in. I started noticing stranger things, long scratches gouged into the bark along that same side path, always fresh, always at shoulder height, as if someone had been dragging a steel rod along as they passed. One morning I found my water bottle, which I'd left tucked at an outcrop halfway down the trail, standing upright on the path, cap unscrewed, water spilled into a neat pile of pine needles 40 feet off the main route. Tracks I didn't recognize circled it, barefoot, wide, toes splayed impossibly far apart. Maybe a prank, maybe an animal. But the next day there were more tracks, in odd looping patterns across the path. Too big and far apart for a human child, too precise for a bear. 3 weeks into October, the orange runner started to appear in other places. Half a mile off, deep at the hilltop, sometimes crouched on a log just outside a patch of fog, head cocked as though listening. I slowed my pace, wary of him, trying not to get too close, but curiosity tinkered with my caution. Once at the small wooden footbridge over the creek, I found footprints damp on the planks, leading out into the ferns but never showing anyone stepping in. Sometimes after these encounters, I'd pass downwind and get the sharp reek of iron, almost metallic, as if a nosebleed was hanging in the air. One morning the fog was thick enough to choke on. I pushed forward, lungs burning, feet wet from melting frost. Ahead, orange flashed once, and I heard the thud of a body veering off path. When I reached the spot, a scrap of orange fabric lay tangled on a low-hanging branch, sticky with a clear, odorless sap that clung to my gloves and refused to wash off for days. I started to feel like the fabric wasn't synthetic. It felt wrong, almost warm even in the cold. The next day it was gone. By late autumn, things escalated. Pine cones arranged in elaborate rings at the trailhead made it hard to step through without breaking the pattern. Thick knots of hair, long, dark, really coarse, hung down from branches that hadn't been low enough for wildlife. Some nights, my running shoes left in the mudroom would be coated with a film of cold sap, and I'd find pine needles jammed into the eyelets. I grew more careful, running only after sunrise, keeping my phone gripped tight, though signal was patchy at best. Still, some mornings I'd catch the orange runner's shape at the edge of the trees, posture hunched, waiting, always watching, never moving when I looked directly. Car windows would mist on the inside, tiny handprints pressed up against the glass, even though I knew the doors were locked. For all my fear, I never stopped running those paths. Maybe I hoped that seeing the runner again in full daylight would prove he was just a real guy, some oddball or silent companion of the woods. But deep down, I worried that if I caught him, there'd be nothing familiar under that hood. Maybe not even a face at all. Maybe someone was tricking me. Most days, I choose to believe it. I still run those trails less often now. Every once in a while, at the edge of a stand of whispering pines, I'll spot a flicker of orange. The forest is full of tricks, light, shadow, memory. But as I catch my breath, alone but not alone, The hair on my arms stands straight up, and some part of me still wonders, what would happen if I ever caught the runner in the pines? Or worse, if he finally caught me? Story number 7. I have always loved my own company. Not an introvert, but the silence felt comfortable to settle into. The reason I took the seasonal ranger position was mostly for the paycheck and the promise of solitude. I never had a real taste for towns or crowds, and when they asked if I'd be willing to do overnights in the old patrol cabin way out on Fire Road 5, the loneliest spot in the whole park, I figured I'd be fine. It was near winter, so the trails out there were mostly empty anyway. No campers, no hikers, just me, my truck, and a wood cabin aging alone in a sea of swaying pines. On the first night, things already felt off. Not scary exactly, just odd. The road in was muddier than it looked on the maps, tire chomped and rutted from the last rain. As I pulled up, my headlights caught the entire front of the cabin splashed with muddy streaks, dried in strange arcs, almost like someone had hurriedly scrubbed at something. A few muddy paw prints or handprints, impossible to tell which, trailed across the deck and over the glass of the main window. I tried to brush it off, chalking it up to raccoons or a black bear nosing around. Inside, the air was cold and stale and smelled sweetly rotten, like old apples left to soften. Dust clung to every surface, and the first thing I did was crack the windows, which only let in the chill, but made the silence easier to bear. The cabin had no electricity, only a propane lantern, and the dying sunlight outside. The park radio sat on the shelf, spitting out nothing but static now and then. I settled in with a book as the sun dipped, heater groaning in the corner. Shadows thickened, and the wind started in, crawling at the door and rattling the old single-pane windows. That was when I heard heavy steps up in the attic loft. I assumed a raccoon, maybe a family of them, settling in for warmth. The footsteps felt too heavy, though. Slow, two or three creaks, then pause. I stomped on the floor and everything went silent. After a while, I went back to my book. Without warning, the clock on the wall started ticking backward, very slowly at first, so it was hard to notice. I thought the mechanism was broken, so I took out the batteries. Even with the batteries gone, the clock hands jerked and twitched, settling finally on 3:14 a.m. and moving no more. I tried to laugh it off, but feeling uneasy, I checked the small crawl space attic anyway. Nothing but old boards and insulation, no animal sounds, no sign of rats or raccoons. The lantern flickered and died. The darkness was thick, almost sticky. I fumbled with the matches and relit it, but as I did, I noticed strange fogging on all the windows, trickles of moisture running down each pane. Even though outside the air was so cold, my breath came out white. As I moved closer to wipe a window, a handprint emerged from inside the fog, rising and pressing hard enough to squeak the glass, palm out and finger spread. I froze, heart thumping, and then the handprint faded, replaced by more. Three more, each at head height, wide apart, pressed in as if something was leaning in from outside. I shoved myself back and tried to focus on practical things, condensation maybe or drafts. By this time, the feeling inside the cabin had changed. The air was dense. My ears rang faintly. I heard crunching and snapping, branches breaking in the clearing around the cabin, making a wide, deliberate circuit. It sounded like slow, dragging footsteps circling me, always just at the edge of sight. I paced the main room, trying not to think about the strange stiffness in my arms, or the sense that the darkened windows were mirrors, hiding something just outside. The radio crackled to life, sharp and static heavy. I could make out what sounded a lot like whispering, long, drawn-out breaths, words at the edge of sense. I thought it might be nighttime interference, or even another ranger at a distant post. But then the station shifted on its own, switching to an AM channel. Through the hiss, I heard an old song warbling and chopped up. I switched the thing off. The heater gave three sharp pops and faded out. In the quiet afterward, I started hearing a faint humming from the walls, almost tuneless, just a vibration, like pipes settling, but more insistent. I grabbed my flashlight and scanned every corner for open vents, holes, or nests. It was then I noticed something carved into the wooden doorframe that I could have sworn wasn't there before. Small, shallow marks in a spiral shape, flecks of old brown caught in the grooves. Not fresh, but not ancient either. I ran my fingers over them and a splinter jabbed me, drawing a bead of blood. I sucked my thumb and tried to tell myself it was old graffiti, maybe made by kids or a bored ranger years ago. Sleep was impossible. When I tried, a sudden banging echoed from the tiny crawl space directly over my cot. It was like someone shuffling possessions or dragging a sack from one side of the attic to the other. The banging stopped as quickly as it started. I told myself it was the wind, even though the air had gone dead still. At one point, the hour must have been close to 2, I caught a flicker outside, like a spark or a match being struck. When I looked, I couldn't see anyone, but there was the scent of burned wood, sharp and sweet, drifting through a window I knew I had closed. A cold draft snaked through the cabin. The worst came right before dawn. At the front door, a circle of muddy, child-sized footprints appeared in the frost, perfectly spaced, facing inward. They trailed up to the step and then vanished. I checked for animals, for loose soil, for anything that would make a print like that, but the ground was hard and frozen. That morning, as the sky paled, the feeling in the cabin faded. I packed up before sunrise under the pretense of an early patrol. When I drove away, I glanced back and saw the handprints had smeared outward, as though something tried to pull away. My phone never picked up a signal that night, but I found a voice memo saved to it the next day. 10 minutes of static. I reported the animal noises and the damage to maintenance. They told me it's probably raccoons, condensation, or a gas leak playing with my head. I don't argue. I just asked not to be assigned Fire Road 5 again, and they nodded, not asking for reasons. Sometimes at night I still dream of the spiral marks and wake up not quite sure if I'm home or still in that freezing, humming cabin, waiting for something to press its hand to the glass.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.